About a year ago, I received in the mail a complimentary copy of Philip Simon's book, Surviving Civilization's Collapse, with Hope, Love, and a Little Humor. Our CUSJ chapter studied it last winter, and we were very concerned about what Philip was saying. So we decided to make climate change our focus for the year. Some of you participated in our letter writing event in February. So I'm very happy that Philip agreed to talk to us this morning, especially as it's so early where he is. I'll just read you a little of his impressive resume. Philip has a Bachelor and Master of Science degree from UBC, specializing in intertidal invertebrates, and a PhD from University of Leiden in the Netherlands in animal behavior. He has worked as a fisheries scientist in New Brunswick, Vancouver Island, and Spain. He ended his working career as a consulting editor for the Canadian Journal of Fisheries and Aquatic Sciences. His interest in animal behavior led him in retirement to social justice work and efforts to understand human behavior and survival. Philip was born and lives in Victoria, where he is a longtime member of the Unitarian Church. He is also a former president of CUSJ and was editor of its journal, Just News, for 12 years. So I'm now going to hand it over to Philip. He has a PowerPoint display and a talk, and we have to hope that the technology cooperates.
Thank you, Sally. That was great. Can you hear? I take it that everybody can hear me. My wife is just asking, can people hear me? I'm sure you probably can. I shall speak up and make sure that you can hear me. I have been concerned about the future of humanity since reading Limits to Growth, which was published in 1972. My concern increased upon reading Beyond the Limits, published 20 years later in 1992 by the same authors. And then, just 4 years ago, I read Jared Diamond's Collapse, published in 2006. I thought this is a book that every person concerned about our future should read, because it tells the stories of earlier civilizations that collapsed and several others that survived, and draws the lessons from those two experiences. But Diamond's book is over 500 pages long. Politicians, teachers, and most students don't have the time to read such a lengthy tome, and the important lessons are buried at the end of the book. I decided I had to write a short guidebook emphasizing the lessons to be learned from Collapse and other books I had read. We needed a book that could be read in an afternoon and that had a positive message for these bleak times. Now we're going to share the screen here. And so here it is, Surviving Civilizations Collapse with Hope, Love, and a Little Humor. It's only 65 pages long, contains lots of illustrations, and has only two graphs. Apparently, some people have trouble with graphs. The following slides will summarize what happened in three earlier civilizations that failed, and in three others that survived, and then draw the lessons and what I believe are the priorities for action needed today. I've got to click on one second here. Slideshow. There we are. Sorry for that. Should be all right now. There we go. You'll understand the relevance of this slide later. Just remember, we share 98.4% of our genes with chimps. Meadows, and Randers developed a computer model showing past and future human populations under a series of different scenarios. This graph is a simplified reproduction from Beyond the Limits. The scenario shows what would happen if we did nothing to avoid the population crash that will occur around the year 2030. Other scenarios described what could happen if we took various actions, singly or in combination. When we do nothing, Our world population climbs to about 9 billion, 9 billion people, at around the year 2030. We're already at 7 billion plus. Then our population collapses to about 3 billion by 2080, 50 years later. I'll let you imagine what would happen during that collapse. If you need any help, there are several fictional accounts, one by a fellow Unitarian, Javid Chernushenko, whose thriller, Burning Souls, I highly recommend. What I'd like to emphasize is the important lesson from Beyond the Limits. We must do a whole lot of things all at once. Tackling one thing at a time won't save us. And that's a problem. Remember our relative in the previous slide, hunched over a typewriter? Some people can think of five different things at once, but I'm not one of them. Neither can a chimp, nor can most of us. It's something to keep in mind. We'll now explore three examples of collapse from Jared Diamond's tome. I think I hit things twice, there we are. And three examples of survival. Now we go to Easter Island. I think almost everyone knows the story of Easter Island. There are several theories about why its population collapsed. They include poor decision-making and leadership, deforestation, lack of boats to fish and hunt seabirds, starvation, and most probably violence. Violence is what worries me most as the cause of the precipitous population crash, the beginnings of which I believe we are already experiencing. A second example of collapse is that of Eric the Red, who sailed to Greenland, put up some tents for a few summers, and then sailed home again, right? That's what I thought as a schoolboy, but I couldn't have been more wrong. Eric the Red and other Norsemen established two colonies, one at the southern tip of Greenland, and a second further north on the western side. These settlements existed for 450 years. Yes, 450 years, and at their peak numbered together about 5,000 people. The Norse in the early 10th century were barbaric Christians. Not all Christians are barbaric, but these ones certainly were. This slide shows the remains of Hvalsey Church in the southern settlement. There were no trees in Greenland to provide wood for smelting iron, and instead of trading walrus ivory with the homeland for useful tools for hunting and gardening, the wealthy Norse leaders squandered their trading goods on religious icons. They made enemies instead of friends with the local Inuit, from whom they could have learned to build boats from bones and skins. Eventually, as climate changed for the worse in the Little Ice Age, all the people in both settlements starved to death. Their inept decision-making was again part of the fatal mix. Third and last of the failed civilizations is Haiti. Most people say Haiti, I use the Spanish pronunciation. On the western end of the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean Sea. The interesting thing about Haiti is that its history after the early 1700s diverged strikingly from the history of the Dominican Republic on the eastern end of the same island. Haiti today is still a failed state. The Dominican Republic on the other end of the same island is relatively successful. How come? Haiti admittedly had a bad start. It had a dense population of 700,000 in 1785, 85% of whom were slaves, many of them the original Tainos people. In 1804, the slaves rebelled against their white masters. They destroyed the plantations to prevent a return to slavery, and productivity and the economy plummeted. A series of unstable governments ensued, ending with the infamous baby Doc Duvalier, who eventually was expelled. A civil society in disarray was not helped by typhoons and earthquakes. Haiti is still a mess. So what happened on the other end of Hispaniola to make the Dominican Republic a relative success? One important factor was that the white population, with fewer slaves, only 30,000 as opposed to 700,000 in Haiti, was receptive to European immigrants and trade. It had its share of violent and ruthless dictators, including Rafael Trujillo and Joaquin Balaguer, but despite undergoing 50 changes of government and 30 revolutions in just 86 years, the Dominican Republic emerged with a stable government sooner than did Haiti. The Dominican Republic was fortunate, too, in having more rain than Haiti, with fertile agricultural valleys. A second success story is that of the island of Tikopia, a tiny speck in the western tropical Pacific. Tikopia is so small you can walk around it in a day. It was first settled around the year 900 BC, and with little outside contact, it continues to flourish today, nearly 3,000 years later. The population of Tikopia was sufficiently small that everyone could have a say in decisions, at least in principle. The big problem for Tikopia was that population growth could outstrip food supply. The people used abortion, infanticide, and virtual suicide, such as setting off on dangerous voyages from which they would not return, to control population growth. Some of these methods are not acceptable today. Tikopians survived for nearly 3,000 years by retaining large trees, remember Easter Island, by controlling their food supply, the eradicated pigs that destroyed vegetable gardens, although pigs were a favorite food of the elites, and they controlled their population numbers. Our third and last success story is Japan. In contrast to Tikopia, which had a bottom-up form of government, the much bigger Japan had a top-down government. From around 1467 until 1615, Japan was wrecked by civil war. But then the shoguns gained power, ruling by military force and establishing peace for the next 200 years until the Americans arrived in 1853. The shoguns and other leaders anticipated crises and acted in their own and others' long-term interests. They established peace and learned to manage their forests. The people obtained near zero population growth by marrying later, nursing babies longer, and making use of contraception, abortion, and infanticide. So what are the secrets to survival that we have learned from these six examples? To me, the following seem to stand out. Wise government. Restricted power of elites and the wealthy. Optimization of food supply. Positive interaction with foreigners and immigrants, and control of population numbers within the limits of available resources. Think about those five secrets of survival, how those five secrets of survival apply to us today. Why do humans make stupid decisions? As Diamond pointed out, we are about a third species of chimpanzee, a very intelligent one, granted. In a weird way, I find this endearing. I love animals because they behave like what they are, and therefore I can't blame humans for being human or being apes. My book explains why and how we make stupid decisions, but we haven't time to explore that today. We'll simply have to accept that being an ape is what we are, make allowances for it, and not blame each other for ape-like stupidities. More important for our survival are the wise decisions we could make to save ourselves. As the success stories have shown, we are capable of making wise decisions as well as stupid ones. To not overtax our chimp brains, here are just four of what I consider to be the priorities for making decisions that will help humanity survive the coming population crash. Develop a strong democracy capable of wise decision-making. Reduce the power of elites by reducing wealth disparity. Reduce human population numbers compassionately, or our numbers will be reduced for us by other means. Mitigate the climate crisis. It's too late to stop it now. We have only time to examine the first two priorities today, but if we can move effectively on these, everything else becomes easier to implement. That's why I think these two first priorities are so important. Information is available elsewhere on ameliorating the climate crisis and reducing global population numbers compassionately. And I was very interested to hear this morning Bruce Heyer's comment that that is one of the biggest problems. It is indeed. There are many things we can do to strengthen our democracy, but since many of these reduce the power of current politicians, the problem is how to get these things passed. I shall return to this theme of transition in my few concluding remarks about the economy. In the meantime, here are a couple of ideas that might be acceptable now. We can introduce some form of proportional representation without a referendum until people have experienced the new system. And we can reduce the lobbying power of corporations and the wealthy who currently control our governments. Control is not too strong a word. This graph is redrawn from the wonderful book, The Spirit Level, by Wilkinson and Pickett. It shows that as national income equality increases towards the right, indices of health and social problems improve. The Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Japan, have among the highest levels of income equality of all developed countries, and the best indices of social and physical health. At the other end of the scale are the US, Portugal, and the UK. They have the greatest disparity in income levels and the worst indices of health and social problems. Canada is about in the middle. We've lots of room for improvement. Taxation is one means of increasing income equality, but it's probably the least popular, especially among the wealthy. Another method is to cap the amount of income by which corporate CEOs, chief executive officers, can exceed the lowest pay of workers at the bottom. There are also other methods. In conclusion, I think our civilization is headed over the cliff, but it's never too late to take some remedial action and turn what could be a catastrophic crash at the bottom of the precipice into a softer landing. I believe we just have to buy ourselves parachutes in the form of taking action. Because like chimpanzees, we seem unable to think of more than a few things at once, I have suggested just four priorities for action: strengthen democracy, bring about more equality in income, start reducing our population numbers, and ameliorate climate change. That ends the slideshow, and I'm coming back to the last part of this talk, which is about the economy. I'm not an economist, but in my book, I did recognize the economy would be one of the casualties of the coming collapse. So I have given it some thought. I didn't mention capitalism's problems in my book because the examples of collapsing and surviving civilizations came from a time before capitalism was a major player. There are many good ideas circulating on how to improve our economy. Most of these are antithetical to the current business model, and therefore, while corporations and the wealthy control our government, they'll be difficult to implement. However, there are a few non-threatening actions we can urge our governments to take now before moving on to more difficult solutions. Capitalism has been successful in bringing us cheap goods by reducing redundancy and increasing efficiency. Corporations produce goods mostly where labor is cheapest, and they close factories in countries where labor is expensive. The danger is that when there's a sudden demand for some product, be it medical face masks or grocery supplies, countries with the factories and fields will tend to look after their own people before worrying about people elsewhere. I live on an island approximately half the size of England, but we produce only 4% of our food. We used to produce a much higher percentage, but our prices were not competitive. Our food mostly arrives by ferry from the mainland, and particularly from places like California. California irrigates its farm crops with water from subterranean sources that are rapidly drawing down. What is our provincial government doing about this looming catastrophe? It's continuing to build houses on the best farmland because our population is steadily growing, and it's flooding good farmland with a huge site C dam. No wonder there's a growing chorus from people concerned about food security. There has been a call for a guaranteed livable income, it has various other names, to help those who have become unemployed as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. If this is implemented, It will help reduce disparity in wealth, and we've seen how beneficial that is. If the guaranteed income plan is extended, as it should be, it will help provide a parachute as we go over the precipice of population collapse. What about instituting a recycling fee on all material products in the same way we do for car batteries? Think what that would do to prices, to built-in obsolescence, to the accumulation of junk, especially plastics. Let your imagination run wild. When we've reclaimed our democracy, we can tackle more controversial issues like closing tax havens, setting limits on individual wealth, and implementing the Tobin tax, which is a tax on international money transfers. This will free up trillions of dollars that we'll need to buy those parachutes for a soft landing at the precipice's bottom. I've talked long enough. If you have any questions, you can find my personal email address on chat. I'll put it as soon as I finish talking. And if you don't find it there, you can find me on the internet and Facebook by searching for Philip Simons, Canadian author. Thank you.